Why the name, the Bed of Procrustes?
Procrustes was a gentleman who had an inn on the road between Athens and a place of worship about 20-some kilometers away. And he abducted travelers, fed them a very nice dinner, and, of course, offered them to spend the night in his famous bed. Now, to make sure the bed fit the person at 100%, no room for imperfection, he stretched those who were too short and cut the limbs of those who were too tall. So, to me, the idea of the bed of Procrustes is changing the wrong variable. Here, the gentleman is in place of the bed. And it came to me as the first time I bought a tailor-made suit in Italy, the gentleman was taking my measurements and trying to fit the suit. And I thought that if the gentleman was an economist, he would probably do surgery on me to fit his suit rather than the other way around.
And you make the nice example of school children and ADHD and feeding them drugs, which is...
Exactly. You want to change their brain so they can fit the curriculum instead of having a more diversified curriculum to be, you know, accommodating idiosyncratic children. So I was very idiosyncratic as a child. I was lucky that my parents had a library, otherwise I'd be now a truck driver or something, because I was not motivated for school precisely for that reason. I was very idiosyncratic with my own tastes, and they wanted to force me to study things that did not interest me in the beginning.
And so the book is a book of aphorisms on that theme, and many of them are critical of the approach of social science, which is about finding models, squeezing data into models rather than trying to find models and impressions of the world that fit the real world.
Actually, it's even worse. There are some Procrustean bed situations in which you completely reverse the reality by reducing it by one dimension. It's exactly as if I wanted to express your genes and reproduce you with 99% of your DNA. I wouldn't get the same human,
right?
Of course. So they don't understand nonlinearity, that there are some cases in which simplification is not just a reduction. It is more than that. It's a distortion.
Yeah. I mean, I should say the very first aphorism in this book, the person you're most afraid to contradict is yourself. It's actually a very powerful one, isn't it? It's absolutely true.
Yeah, you're a prisoner. You have an idea, and then you change all subsequent ideas to fit your initial one.
To fit your preconception. Some of them, we should say, are just downright funny. I think you have one about, I wonder whether cannibals and lions would pay a premium for free-range humans. I should ask, where did you think of all of these? I mean, it must have taken you ages to sit down and write a book of aphorisms.
Strangely enough, I started taking walks. I discovered that I the paleo lifestyle, where you take long walks and try to live a life that's as unpoisoned by modern technology as you can. So I decided, okay, the way I could do it is by taking long walks and freeing up a lot of my time, just like hunter-gatherers. And suddenly these started popping up. So in 4 months, I had close to 500 aphorisms.
It's a very original book. Now, look, I have to say, you're pretty hard on journalists and economists. Journalist should yeah. feel probably mortally wounded. Let me see if I can find some examples. I think page 86, as I scroll ahead here, there's one about, there we go. There are designations like economist, prostitute, or consultant for which additional characterization doesn't add information. I suppose the consultants get it harder than the economists, actually.
Yeah, no, they definitely. No, anyone who has to change his ethics to fit his condition, profession, or social rank, to me, is committing a cardinal sin, and consultants tend to commit that one more than others.
A mathematician starts with a problem and creates a solution. A consultant starts by offering a solution and creates a problem. I suppose it's a common accusation. Do you ever? I mean, you're a controversial guy in some respects. You divide opinion because you've got a tremendous intellectual confidence. Some would probably say arrogance. Do you ever think you might be guilty of some of the sins you describe in your own books?
Not really, because I always defer to the greatest of all, Mother Nature. You see, in all these aphorisms, you'll see that Mother Nature is a non-Procrustean bed. It has 3 billion years of experience and counting. It has done things in a certain way. The human body is very idiosyncratic. I mean, each one of us has his own genetic makeup and preferences. And we, so I defer to Mother Nature, the way it built things, you know, in this book and other books as well. And I defer to it. So I'm not arrogant in a sense, what I call epistemic arrogant, thinking I know it all. I'm critical of others and people that, you know, perceive it as arrogance. What I am is a skeptic. It's very, very different.
Yeah. You're famous, of course, for your books on randomness, chance, and small probability events. And you have a chapter in here about that. I think this is a very interesting aphorism, actually stuck with me. The tragedy is that much of what you think is random is in your control. And what's worse, the opposite, i.e. everything that you think is in your control is random. It is, I suppose, in some sense, the fundamental message that your books between them have. If you took away one line, that might be it.
Yeah, that would be it, or it would be probably the story about the ethics that people tend to. A modern man fits his ethics to his profession rather than fit his profession to his ethics.
Yeah, well, we should say that on page 103 you have one. If my detractors knew me better, they'd hate me more. I wonder if that's true.
No, I think it would be. It was a joke. It was half in jest, but. No, because they'd be scared even more.